Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Friend Show. I am your host, Nicholas Lorimer, and today I'm joined by Mr. Tieko Tsotse. Tieko, how are you doing, man?
I'm doing good things, and how are you, Nick?
I'm pretty good, all things considered. And, of course, we're also joined by Mr. Gabriel Krauser. Gabriel, good to have you back on the show. Welcome.
Thank you. It's nice to be back in Joburg and be with you guys.
Indeed. All right, let us get into first a word from our sponsor, and that is, of course, Bitvice. So Bitvice says that Bitcoin is the complete hedge against the global debasement of money, inflation, and government overreach. Bitvice is a South African-first Bitcoin-only self-custody solution that helps individuals and entities buy and hold Bitcoin for the long term. Bitvice believes that everyone should hold their own Bitcoin and trust no one else. Recently, there have been a plethora of crypto custodians going bankrupt, taking their clients' Bitcoin with them. This is why Bitvice never holds your Bitcoin. They send it immediately to your own Bitcoin wallet, where you hold the keys. Not your keys, not your coins. Simply sign up to Bitvice, link your bank account securely, and buy Bitcoin in seconds. Visit bitvice.io and begin your journey in buying and securing the scarcest asset that mankind has ever created. Right, let us get into the news of today. And this is a story that was sent to me by Gabriel. And according to the Knight Frank Global House Price Index, there has been a lot of pressure on global housing prices from inflation. A lot of people, they buy a house and they expect it to appreciate in value, to be one of the main assets that kind of where their finances are tied up. And it's considered often a kind of cornerstone of middle class life is if you own your own house. Well, this index tracks 56 countries to look at the prices of housing across the world. And they found that inflation has been pretty bad for people who are hoping to see their house prices go up in real terms. And perhaps unsurprisingly, of the 56 countries measured, 47th in that list in terms of performance was South Africa, where although our house prices grew by 3.6% in nominal terms, if you adjust that for inflation, South African houses on average seem to have lost 3.6% in value compared to last year. And this is, of course, driven partly by inflation, but there are other things as well, I think, behind this. And compared to other countries, we're not doing so hot. We are ahead of, Gabriel informs me, Ukraine. So it turns out things could be worse. But Gabriel, the story piqued your interest. I mean, is why is South Africa doing so poorly on this ranking?
Yeah, so it's worth pointing out we're doing better than Ukraine. You know, our housing market on this evaluation shrunk by 3.5%. Ukraine shrank by 7%. And if you look at some of the other places that are doing worse than us, there are similar major dislocations. Whereas South Africa seems to be in a position where it's not really grabbing global headlines. It's of immediate concern to anyone who's trying to buy or sell a house. And it's pretty obvious, I think, on the ground, even to people who can hardly even dream of getting to that place. But it's worth considering, I think, because it is sailing under the radar. One of the background facts that is worth bearing in mind is that South Africa's housing stock and its property market in general, if you add it all together, you take away the debt, you get the net asset value of the country, businesses, housing, stocks, bonds, everything domestic. And that comes out to slightly less than twice GDP, which is the global annual output. Now, anyone who's thought about retirement will tell you that if you are earning X and your total assets are worth 2X, you're not in a very good position for retirement because you're going to start eating your assets and you're going to have nothing left very quickly. So humans have a natural capital to wealth ratio, or sort of capital to income ratio, how much you're worth versus how much you're earning. And as you get older and older, you expect that to climb so that you have a chance at a decent retirement. Countries have their own ratios, and it turns out the international norm is about 5 to 1. some very wealthy countries. Spain sits at about 8-9 to 1. Some very dynamic countries like America sit around 4-5, 4.5, 5 to 1. So, you know, it's super productive, but it's building up some wealth. South Africa is almost unique at sitting at below 2 to 1. Means, you know, every 2 years we make as much as we've managed to store across all of history. And in that position, the one thing that we know for sure from historical data is that you should be sitting on a housing boom in the making. That's when housing values, when the housing ratio is so low, people are so productive, but they haven't saved up very much. Something's been holding the economy back. Something's been holding savers back from accumulating wealth. You change that and you get a huge housing boom, 10% annual increases, and you get in a position where you grow a middle class, or take the middle class that there already is and you double its size very quickly, if not more. South Africa is going in the opposite direction. We're in the worst position. It should be so easy to grow, but we're growing. We're shrinking. Why is that? If you look at the last year, a lot of it comes down to collapsing infrastructure, extended load shedding, extended lockdowns, government interventions getting in the way.
There was a story recently that said that something like a fifth of all housing sales are related to emigration at the moment.
Yeah. So people are kind of sick of it. And that means that there's more buyers than sellers. Wait, am I getting that right? More sellers than buyers.
More sellers than buyers, yes.
So it's just, and the cycle perpetuates itself because people realize that there's a gloomy situation. Then it's even harder. And just to make matters really nice and bad, we have the looming expropriation bill, which allows expropriation without compensation. Remember, EWC was about to come through last year through a constitutional amendment that had a depressive effect on markets, according to banks who run the numbers. That threat was lifted momentarily, but then brought back by Ramaphosa a month or two ago. And now the bill is getting its vote on the wording next week, Wednesday, and then it'll go to the floor of Parliament, where it only needs a simple majority to go through. That allows the government to take your property away if you've bought it for the sake of selling it for a profit. That's one of the conditions it has in mind. It also says that basically if you have a property and it's invaded and you lose control over it, then the government can take away the title deed, finish the job. Also says there are other situations where we can take away your property that we can't even think of. So, you know, it's a middle finger to investors. It's really giving the chop to the unemployed and saying, you know, get used to it. It's not good. Thanks, Nick.
Indeed. Tiago, your thoughts on this? I mean, you know, I remember once being told a story about one of my relatives who was, you know, in politics many years ago. And the advice they were given was, when you're dealing with voters, never, ever, ever threaten their property values. Because if you do, they will vote you out very quickly, or at least they will be very upset. And that, I think, reflects something about how, for a lot of people, housing prices really are important to their kind of financial well-being. What do you make of this story, and what do you make of the causes of our current predicament, Tiago?
Well, I think there are many causes to the current predicament, as Gabriel has mentioned. We do, of course, have, as you have mentioned, a lot of people leaving the country due to the country not doing well. The reality of the matter is that South Africa, where we stand right now, we are really at the brink of a socioeconomic and political collapse. If things are not fixed as soon as possible, we might wake up one day in a Zimbabwe situation. So indeed, there are more people selling houses than those who are buying, and therefore values of houses are going down since the demand is low. But I do think that if we were to have if the government was to get its stuff right, if we were to have a situation whereby majority of the people were employed, money was flowing around, then the values of these properties would come up again. You know, I just forgot what your second question was, Nick, what your cousin advised. Oh, yeah, it was around property rights. I think your cousin is very, very, very correct that when it comes to voters, particularly those who own properties, they don't want their property rights touched. And it makes logical sense, right? I mean, we take loans against our properties and stuff of that nature, and that's how we sustain ourselves. Once that is gone, then you are left in a situation whereby you can't take a loan against that. You don't own property. You live under the government. At any given point in time, they can say whatever. It's almost like what's happened in rural areas, in some rural areas, because the residents of these rural areas don't own land. When they have disagreements with the chiefs, they can very easily say, get off our land and we don't want you here anymore. So no one wants to live in such a country, right? You want to live in a country whereby you own your own property and you know that it's yours. No one else owns the property, it's yours, and it ends right there. Really, the people who are in support of taking away property rights, many times if you look at it, it's people who don't own properties. If you find that there are amongst them those who own properties, it's normally those who don't understand the whole concept and how it would impact their own lives. So you check members of organizations such as the EFF, those who stay, say, in suburbs, townships where they have title deeds and stuff of that nature. You speak to them at a personal level, they tell you that they still want their private property rights, but somehow they want the government to own all land. So you wonder how that is going to play around. So it's normally people who own property and understand very well what nationalization means, and taking back the land, giving it to the government to handle and for the government to own all of the land. They know very well what it entails and, wouldn't dare vote for such a policy position.
Any final thoughts on this topic, Gabriel, before we move on?
Yeah, just one. I was asked a couple of weeks ago in an interview about the expropriation bill, general threats to property rights. Would you invest in South Africa? Would you buy property here, given these conditions? And my answer was yes, if you also consider, in my case, yes, considering that part of the investment is the money put into the property, and part of the investment is the energy, time, and money put into the public square, put into the debate, put into the battle of ideas. It's much like private security. I need private security in South Africa. I think most people do. Some people can afford it. It's tricky, but you do. And that's an extra part of the investment. It's like, would you buy it without that? Maybe not. But if you're going to go that extra mile, then it starts to make sense. And I like thinking about public security. Are you secure against the predations of the state? Are you protected from the army and the police? And the answer is just determined by the rules. What are the rules? Do the rules say they're not allowed to take your stuff, or do the rules say you're allowed to take your stuff? So I think people who invest in private security in order to make sense of their property investment should seriously think about investing in public security to defend themselves from EWC.
I really like that. That's a great term, public security. All right. And if you're enjoying the show, please do like the video. Please do subscribe to our YouTube channel. And please do leave us good podcast reviews. We'd really appreciate that. And it helps us to spread the tentacles of our influence throughout the body politic of South Africa. Okay. Let's go on to our next story. We're going to, I think, cover this one quite briefly. But there's been a case recently where a 65-year-old police officer stationed within the Durban Organized Crime Unit has been sentenced to 15 years in jail for stealing firearms. Daniel Reneker was a warrant officer with SAPS, and according to the court, he would take firearms seized in crimes he was investigating home with him. And when the police searched his property, they found a significant number of firearms, as well as in a nearby river where he apparently was throwing them. And, you know, this is in of itself not a truly interesting story, except to say that I think it's quite symptomatic of the ways in which firearms in this country often go missing, often at the hands of the police. So this case doesn't seem to be as bad as some of the other ones we've heard, because in this case, the police officer does not appear to have been selling them to criminal gangs. Of course, South Africa's had a famous case. I think it was a Colonel Prinsloo, I think I'm correct in saying, who was caught selling firearms to Cape Flats gangs. And even worse, it was firearms that civilians had handed in for destruction. Gabriel, what do you make of the story?
Yeah, no, Nick, I think you've summarized it very well. Symbolic of a much deeper issue. And I thought I'd just add a little anecdote. Last week I was at ENCA, at a sort of crime in Daba, which was, you know, an hour and a half of television with a couple of panelists and a few community leaders, as it were, Don't know what I was doing there. I was speaking my mind. And it was generally a pretty grim affair because you had a lot of people saying things like, all of the crime is done by Nigerians and Zimbabweans, and we need to wipe them out. I would say that kind of talk took about 40, 45 minutes of the hour and a half. Another 20 minutes was taken up by a battle between MK veterans and other struggle revolutionaries about whether the MK veterans were did any good. One side saying they did all the good, the other side saying they did none at all. So what you're saying is
it was a debate with lots of good content and focusing on the real issues.
Completely unemotional, sober and judicious, informative, and definitely solutions-oriented. Opposite of all of that, unfortunately. But there was the Deputy National Commissioner of SAPS, the second most important officer in the hierarchy, Officer Fani Masemola, and she was bragging, and I thought, what a wonderful turn of phrase, about how many cops had been taken from blue uniforms to orange overalls. And I couldn't contain myself. I said, could you give us a number, please? And she said, no. I said, could you give us a vague estimate, please? And she said, no. But we're working very hard and we've got a great plan for getting rid of the corrupt cops. And I said, what? Why did you end Operation Impi, which was led by Jeremy Vary and Issy Maisels, both of whom have now completely been removed from the SAPS. They were the guys who uncovered over thousands of guns that were being sold directly into the Cape Flats, into the hands of gangsters, connected with hundreds and thousands of deaths. I think hundreds of children literally murdered by these guns sold by the cops to the gangsters. She said, no, the operation's not over. So I thought that's a nice concession because we had a little letter writing campaign to try and draw that out. No one was prepared to answer that in writing, but we have it now on camera. And I said, so what has happened? What's the latest that has happened? Because it was not just one officer in that thing. It's thousands of guns that were sold. There was a lot of money moving. He was just a little middleman. And she couldn't name anything that had happened recently. And just for a few moments after that, the crowd reoriented itself away from this away from the other kinds of debates and started confronting the issues of accountability in governance and the fed upness. That's not a word. Anyway, the grave frustration with promises made and unkept. Someone from the Soweto People's Parliament said, you know what, we need to get rid of the government and make merit-based appointments in the police service. I was very glad to hear that. More of that.
Yeah. Indeed, there's many things I think I disagree with the Soweto People's Parliament on, but that is one I think I can definitely get behind. Diego, what do you make of this story? I mean, this is, I think, really highlights the reasons why South Africans have such low trust in the cops. I think they continue to be one of the least trusted of all public institutions in the country.
Yeah, well, they sell everything they collect. You come to Polokwane right now. I am in a place called Rainbow Park, Ward 19 of Polokwane. And there are probably around 7 people in this area who sell weed that's delivered to them by a policewoman. So they collect the weed from wherever they collect it. They bring it here. They sell it around here. So they steal everything from weed to guns, alcohol, everything that they collect, they steal and see what they can do with it. Sometimes they use it for personal reasons, sometimes they sell it, but a lot of times they sell it. So perhaps it's worth even congratulating this one for at least keeping the guns and not selling them like the others have done. But really, this has become the reality in South Africa. We can't trust the police at all. You go to Pretoria as well. Next, like I've mentioned before, like next to Bosman, they literally deliver weed to those people, but not only weed, drugs that they collect, cocaine and everything. They give them to the guys next to Bosman to sell. There is a crisis that we have at this current moment in South Africa. We really just can't trust our policemen and women. But of course, it's not all of them that are doing this. But it's really too many of them doing this, and yeah, without consequences being around for them to feel, you know.
Yeah, that's exactly it.
Can I chip in with just, you know, a wonderful idea that has often been proposed by the Institute of Race Relations? Is that, well, how do you deal with this? How do you get consequences going? Kes custodet ipsos custodiet. Who guards the guardians, really, is the question. If the police are corrupt, who are you going to call? So, you know, you could call Ghostbusters And that's usually what the debate ends up being. We need better leadership.
Yeah, according to a DA research project recently, something like 40% of police stations don't have working telephones. So calling is probably not the right place to start anyway.
But what you can, and look, the DA has shown that with a bit of devolution of power in the Western Cape. I thought it was amazing that, you know, murders up 16% quarter on quarter, 22% the quarter before that. It's up, you know, 40% year on year. Hijackings are up 100% year on year. It is double, you know, hijacking capital of the world, well, double it. It really is a nightmare, but the DA showed in some places where they put in devolved policing, municipal and province-wide policing, that they managed to bring murder rates down in some of the scariest parts of the country. So devolution, very good. And the ultimate devolution, the ultimate simplest form of accountability is just let South Africans vote for their station commanders. People know if their station commander is doing a good job or a bad job. And I think that is the kind of program that could immediately change the face of South Africa if it was given a chance.
No, definitely. And of course, you know, one must have sympathy for the cops sometimes. So there was a case recently where some illegal miners in a sort of in an armed gang with automatic weapons attacked a mine, and the mine called the police for help. And the police sent two slightly portly police officers and a bucky. That's it. And I don't really see how you're supposed to stop an armed gang of Zama Zamas with two guys in a bucky. So yeah, no, it's not nice being a police officer in this country. I'm not particularly surprised that some of them turned to doing strange things like taking guns home from investigation scenes. Anyway, more devolution to the people, I think. As you say, Gabe, we'll go a long way to fixing this. Okay, let's go on to our next topic. And this is, there was an Afrobarometer survey a while ago about countries across Africa and their attitudes towards traditional leaders, chiefs, kings, that sort of thing. And they found that a lot of countries across Africa had a sort of fairly positive view of chiefs, but there were some that really, really didn't like chiefs. Among them were South Africa, Zimbabwe, Morocco, Tanzania, Ghana, Sudan, Mozambique. And it's quite interesting, I think, to think about, you know, what is the role and the place of chiefs in a modern republic, in a society like South Africa, where, you know, we simultaneously have chiefs kind of included in the constitution, but at the same time, we are fundamentally a constitutional democratic republic where we elect our leaders. According to the survey, fewer than 4 in 10 citizens have any sort of trust in traditional leaders, while at the same time, people say that 68% of respondents said that chiefs have some or a lot of influence in their area. Kiyoko, as a person who doesn't have a lot of trust in traditional leaders, what are your thoughts on the topic?
Well, I think I can speak about Limpopo and the chiefs here. The chiefs here are not respected by residents of their areas anymore. They literally don't listen to them anymore because they've realized that there's really nothing that they do. Let's go to all the rural areas in Limpopo and ask all of them, all of the citizens, what has your chief really done in your area? What they really do, apart from earning a salary from the treasury, of course, a lot of times they are just busy fiddling with businesses, wanting to get something from there, fiddling when they are tenders, wanting to get something for themselves. The Gasford area, for example, you go to the chiefs that side, all they really do, they don't take care of the citizens at all. They do nothing for the communities, no cultural activities, no nothing. All they do is to run after the mines there and tell them that, no, as a community, we have percentages in these mines and we must therefore get something as a community. When the money comes, they chow all of it. Build houses, drive Range Rovers, buy houses in Sandton and stuff of that nature. There's really nothing constructive that chiefs do in modern day South Africa. But the most frustrating thing is that we have them on as permanent leaders who are apparently born leaders, which is an idea that does not make sense to begin with. Chiefs, when chiefs came about, they came about as custodians of land, right? We now have a government that's in a way already doing that. We have title deeds. Give people title deeds. What's remaining, there's a government there. give that to the private sector and stuff of that nature. They are not using it at all. We are faced with an economic crisis in South Africa. Many of these chiefs sit in areas where really, really, if they were active chiefs who went out to look for businesses to come into their areas and stuff of that nature, young people and old people in their areas would be employed. We have people from rural areas, all of them flocking into townships, flocking into towns, cities to look for jobs and stuff of that nature. No economic development plans in these rural areas, nothing. So really, one just wonders why we still have them, because all they do is to earn a salary, meet with ANC cadres and discuss how we are going to do 1, 2, 3, and 4 that has nothing completely to do with the community. I almost said something, but thought, let me hold it back. But outside that, there is really nothing constructive at all that chiefs in South Africa at this point in time do. What's remaining really is a hungover of the past, and that, yeah, this and this, we were strong, we had these powers, this was our community and all of that. But in real life at the moment, there is nothing. It's just a hangover, this thing of chiefs. Nothing is remaining for them, really.
Gabriel, do you think that, you know, chiefs are compatible with our republic? Can we make them work for the people in a way that they add value rather than just rent seek?
Yeah, it's a tall order. I kind of think that it could be possible. Let me just take a step back and say about the Afrobarometer report. I saw this news story in News 24 today. No link to the report that the story is about, which is pretty typical. I then went to look up the report, and I found the report, at least where those quotes were directly, I saw them from over a year ago. So I think it's slightly strange reporting. I'm not a fan of that. I then went onto Afrobarometer's website and looked at their dispatches and found nothing in the last few months about this topic. So I'm pretty sure I found the right one that was just being jazzed up. Started out recently, a report came out. You said a while ago. So good on you, Nick, for outperforming the shady journalist. Okay, that's just a bugbear. On the substantial question, I think part of what's – there's two things. One is obviously some chiefs are good, some chiefs are bad. I have interacted with chiefs that are doing really good work in rural KZN in very trying conditions, keeping the peace, often where there is effectively no government because there are no title deeds and there's no policeman who's going to come and do anything useful. So if you want to protect yourself, you do need some coordinated force, and that is governed effectively by an Nkosi Nduna, so maybe just an Nduna. On the other hand, we have the constitutional order and customary law. They sometimes seem to sail past each other. I think where they can work in a kind of synergy is in family law, where I have some personal experience. I work for a senior advocate, acting judge sometimes, as a kind of paralegal. And it's clear to me that it would be a huge nightmare to legislate for polygamous marriage arrangements. So the current status quo is if you have a legal conventional marriage, then it can't be polygamous, and there are certain international laws and common law and statutory laws, things that have been written out about who gets custody of the children in the event of a divorce and so on and so forth. It's a very complicated business when you want to do it through polygamy. And so that's been kept in its sort of own bucket. And I think that's fair. I actually think that's better. I think if you try to bring them together, you'd break one or the other or both. But property rights and criminal law is where I think it's just a very black and white issue. You need to privatize the land that the chiefs are living over. And I think that would hurt the bad ones the most. And I think the good ones would find themselves elevated voluntarily by their communities in the aftermath of that, as something like a spiritual leader. And you know, where that works out, that's fine. And they can be custodians of customary law insofar as it applies to the family law side, for example. And where it, and where they get rejected by their communities once they have the power to run their own lives. That's what'll happen. And just to say, you know, if I visited a little bit of Europe, it's nice to go around parts of Scotland and Wales, parts of the world where traditional leaders through blood right, which is a very weird idea, where they've become just symbolical figureheads that kind of remind people of a consistent through line in tradition. And I think that does sometimes keep things even when other aspects of life are kind of swinging wildly like pendulums. It kind of just keeps an even keel. So there's something to that. There's some value that I wouldn't want to throw away if possible. But the first priority has got to be privatizing the land, handing out the title deeds, giving people access to police force that's going to enforce the law rather than relying on chiefs whipping Ntombazans if they've misbehaved. That doesn't really work.
Yes, indeed. We've had a very sort of give power back to the people kind of episode here today, but I think that's all very good. And we are out of time, so we aren't able to talk about our last one, but just a little reminder here that it apparently Ramaphosa has to give some information to the South African Reserve Bank about what he was doing with all of that foreign currency, which he did.
And he must give information to our lawyers who've been pressing him on why he suspended Mkhwebane the day after she started the Palapala investigation, as opposed to 2 years earlier he had the power to do so on the reason that
He's had a lot of good reasons to fire her for a very long time, and yet it took him until to the
and then one bad reason, one conflict of interest reason. So what's going on there? We will tell you once he releases the documents that he says constitute the process and explain the story. He still hasn't released them despite our lawyers' letters. So.
We'll have to see how that develops. Anyway, thank you very much for listening. We will see you next week on the Daily Friend Show, and we hope that you have a great one. Cheers, everyone.